Pop the we might say the meanest things. Pop the sometimes when not much company. There's no rearranging, our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, Pop the you belong to us. Pop the
howdy, stranger. Welcome to episode 16 of the Pop Dose podcast. In case you've forgotten, I'm Dave Lifton, and it has been a while. We'll get to that in a second, but first, let me introduce my co-hosts, Jeff Giles and Jason Hare. Gentlemen.
Sup, fuckers?
Sup, fuckers?
Aha, I beat you this time, bitch.
Nah, in my microphone, it came out exactly the same time.
I can always play around in the editing to make it happen at the exact same time.
Right. We'll see. We'll see whoever's nicer to Dave this episode gets to go first in the editing.
And here's why we haven't put out a podcast since Thanksgiving.
You said put out. You totally did.
I know.
You totally did.
That's because your mom didn't put out.
Oh!
First time since 1953.
Well, what happened was we got a little busy during the holidays, as is so often the case, and that continued into January. Then we finally got together in mid-January and recorded a great show with our fellow Pop Dose colleague, Matt Wardlaw.
I blew it.
And, yeah, I'll let Jason describe what happened.
I blew it. Basically, my computer sucks, and so we got through the entire episode. And then, long story short, my computer crashed. So I recorded, like, three separate sound files for the episode. And they all of them but the last one were lost. So we could have had a podcast consisting of, like, the last 9 minutes.
It was a good one, too.
Yeah.
Was it? Because I can't remember for the life of me what we talked about.
I can't either, but it was a good show.
We talked about what we expect out of what we're looking forward to in the coming year.
That's right. I'm looking forward to a new computer.
I'm looking forward to winning.
Oh, God. Oh, I don't want to go near that.
Oh, really? No.
No, listen, I'm as burned out as you guys are, but that is going to survive, I think, from all this Charlie Sheen thing.
Just the winning?
And I'm happy about that. I love seeing that hashtag after people's tweets. I think that's so funny.
The best line that I heard about Charlie Sheen was, now that he's on Twitter, he smoked the hash out of all the tags.
I just think winning is a funny hashtag. I mean...
It is, but what it comes from is just...
Pretty tragic, yes. But also, you know, Fuck Mike Love is a funny hashtag that came out of tragedy, too. So, you know, precedent has been set.
Comedy is tragedy plus time.
That's right.
As Alan Alda said in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
But Charlie Sheen isn't giving us any time.
He'll be dead soon enough.
I just want it all to go away. And the sad thing was something happened to me yesterday where I thought about what happened to me and I was like, winning would be a great hashtag for the news right now, but I don't want to do it.
How funny is this news cycle now? What was it? Did we even know about this shit 2 weeks ago? And already everybody's tired of it.
Yeah, I did like the his response. I don't know if you saw what Roger Ebert wrote. He said, you know, something about him being a sad, lonely man. And then Sheen responded by saying, yeah, if you think loneliness is going to town on five chicks at once.
Yeah, I don't think Charlie Sheen is sad or lonely.
I think it's sad.
Yeah.
He might be, well, it's sad from the outside, but I don't think
he's feeling sad right now. No, he's feeling great.
Then, hey, I mean, what if it turns out that this dude is not actually a drug addict?
I think then the entire definition of addiction has to be rewritten.
Just because he passed his 72-hour drug test doesn't mean that he's not, it just means he didn't do drugs for 72 hours.
It means he went to sleep.
It could just mean he's insane, you know? It might have nothing to do with drugs. Maybe he was just always this crazy, and he had, you know, he had handlers who were, who obviously weren't capable enough to stop him from doing shit like The Arrival, or Young Guns 2, but...
Well, here's the thing. As a society, we all love a train wreck, but it's very rare that we see a train wreck where someone comes out and goes, you know, and is, like, triumphant about it. You know, we're used to Robert Downey Jr. waking up in a child's bed and then going to rehab and being regretful. And then you get happy sometimes on the other end if the person comes out of it okay. But this is someone who's like, yeah, I do drugs, you know, or whatever. He's like, you know, so what? I'm awesome. So there's something to, I mean, the question is how long can you ride that? But we'll see. It certainly is interesting.
So we're all winning today.
We are winning. I'm very excited to be doing this podcast.
We're all winning until we start the discussion, I think.
No, I think today...
Because there's a lot of losing out
here. Oh, I disagree. I disagree. Well, Dave, you want to tell our...
Sure. We're gonna do something that we did nearly 3 years ago on my old podcast, and that's an installment of one of the original features of PopDisc, one that extends even farther back, or further back, I'm not actually sure which is which, to Jason's old website, and that is Chart Attack.
Woohoo!
I miss Chart Attack.
Yes, we definitely all do. And Jason, talk about what Chart Attack is.
I miss Chart Attack too. I'm hoping to write some Chart Attacks this year. Chart Attack is a series I started in 2006 maybe. Thank you. Basically, it's just a series where we take a Billboard Top 10 from the past. I usually keep it somewhere between the early 70s and I don't think I've gone past 1992 or 93. We take a Top 10 from the Billboard Hot 100, somewhere in there, look at the songs, discuss them, dissect them, make fun of them, the whole thing. It's a lot of fun to do. It's a lot of work, too, which is why I don't get to do it as often as I'd like, because I like to make them comprehensive and funny.
You make everything harder than it has to be.
But we had a lot of fun when we did it on the Wings for Wheels podcast, taking apart a top 10. So we're here to do it again.
And to honor our tradition, our shared tradition, I have no idea which chart we're covering.
Well, and I could have bet that that's what you were going to, how you were going to approach
it. Hey, at least I knew we were recording today. I showed up.
Yeah,
that is true. But the problem is you're so good that you'll have tons of really great things to say about all this shit. Anyway,
I think the last show we did, I don't even think I ever listened to it because I was so ashamed of myself, but I think the last show we did, a Chart Attack show we did, I just said everything sucked.
Well, get ready.
Yeah, it was great.
That's buckle right. up, cowboy.
So, okay, Jeff, well, put on your members-only jacket and let's take a trip back to the week of March 9th, 1985. And the number 10 song that week was Misled by Kool & the Gang.
Sure if I know this one.
I just want to let everybody know that I actually like every song on this chart. That's not going to come as a surprise to anybody. I seriously like every song. You don't know Misled?
Play it for me. Can you do that?
I cannot, actually. I can't play.
Son of a bitch. Because
I've got everything going through my headphones.
YouTube.
Why don't you listen to... Dave, look, we prepare. We can talk about this song. Well, Jeff does whatever he wants. Go ahead.
I don't have that much.
Awesome!
I don't have that much to say about this. It's kind of schizo. I think it's got a pretty good pop melody with some hooks, and you know they're still going for their funk roots with that scratchy guitar in there, and they've added some synths to make it modern. And some hey, now we're hearing it.
The video actually is one of those videos that tells a story.
Yeah, we're gonna. I got some thoughts on the video.
Oh my god.
Just skip ahead, Jeff. You gotta know. Just go to the chorus.
No. I need to see this. I need to bring back Captain Video for this video, actually. This motherfucker raided Michael Jackson's closet before the video was filmed. Is that James JT Taylor?
Yeah, that is. I'll have you know that JT is the only one in the video until the very end. All the members show up at the end, which meant they had to put in about 25 minutes of work.
This video rips off Indiana Jones.
It sure does. There's a whole middle part. And actually, the younger black kid in the video is JT's cousin.
This is the best video ever made.
That is categorically untrue.
No. There's
it's
glitter.
Untrue.
There are unnecessary zippers. There are men in turbans. There's a storyline that makes no sense at all.
See, Jeff and comes up with all the stuff right off the spot.
And there's Soul Glow, and then there's this chick who's dressed all in white and wearing white pancake makeup. This is awesome.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what's going on with the girl in the white makeup. I'm not exactly sure. This is the kind of video that, if it was done today, would be done completely ironically.
Yeah. But I have a theory that most production budgets in the 80s for videos were snorted.
Yeah, that's what we said on the last one.
Yeah, and this just, you know, that they just took what was left over and just made shit up.
Well, no, well, yeah, but this video has, like, serious work went into this video.
Yeah, you're right. For the time and for what kind of nonsensical crap is in this video, there's some serious
production. Well, and remember, it was 85, so when did Temple of Doom come out?
It was around
around the same time, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that woman I thought was like a physical manifestation of the woman at the end of, right, you know, the "she's beautiful" before the face melts.
Ah.
So I do know this song. I don't know it as well as the other hits that they had in that era, but I do know this.
No, this is, you know, and this is like one of those songs that I would personally love to do in acoustic 80s, except I just think nobody would know it. You know, because if you're going to do a Kool & the Gang song from the 80s, you're going to do Cherish or you're going to do Fresh.
Right.
Or even Celebration was, I think, 1980, but you can't.
And also, like a lot of songs from the era, it isn't so much about the hook as it is about the production. If you tried to do it acoustically, it wouldn't be much of a song.
Yeah, this song is very similar, actually, to their other song, Victory. Kind of really stays on one chord the entire song. Actually, Fresh does that, now that I think about it. I think Fresh is only a couple of chords. There's a bridge that nobody really remembers. And this song has a very brief bridge that when I heard it, I was like, I've never heard this before in my life. but the song does have the lyric, "She's as heavy..." Is it "she is as heavy"? Something's as heavy as a Chevy. I like that. We're out of ideas, everybody. Heavy as a Chevy. So this song peaked at number 10. This was as far as this one went.
Was Joanna or Cherish after this?
That's a good question.
I seem to remember them all being around the same 84, time. 85, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they had another hit after this. Clearly I'm too lazy to look it up.
Yeah, but this was like my problem with the song. It's got all these things that are going on there. When you listen to it, it's not that bad, but it's just not memorable.
Yeah. I still like it, although that's not surprising to anybody, but... yes, I like it. Let's see. Let's see if they had any other hits after this. I should have known this ahead of time. Both Fresh and Cherish were after this. Misled was the first single from, I guess it was the lead-off single from this album. And it hit number 10. Fresh only hit number 9, huh?
Victory was from the next year.
Yeah, Victory was from 86.
From the ironically titled Forever. They're all back together now, aren't they?
I don't know.
Playing in an Indian casino near you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there was a whole thing with JT back in the 80s, right? I mean, when he wasn't in the original group, but when he joined, he was suddenly like the face of Coolio. That's why he's the only one you see in the video. You know, he was one of those guys that was kind of meant for videos. He was like meant for video stardom.
Just say it. He's a handsome guy.
No, he is a handsome guy.
His Wikipedia page is interesting.
Yeah, is he back with Kool & the Gang?
Well, it says Taylor returned to Kool & the Gang in 1995. However, Taylor was not on Kool & the Gang's 2007 release, Still Cool.
All right. Well, we don't have to spend too much more time on Kool & the Gang.
Although we should mention that last May, they did a 2-night stand in Jerusalem.
Well, of course, because Celebration is played at every bar mitzvah.
Bar mitzvah, that's right.
That and YMCA. They probably had to do. They probably thought they were getting the Village People going again. The book. Number 9, Sugar Walls, Sheena Easton.
Oh, Sugar Walls.
Yes.
Sugar
Walls. Shows how unstoppable Prince was, that he could give an obscene song to a marginally talented singer and still have a top ten hit with it.
Last week I was listening to Don't Dream It's Over. And I was thinking about how the song is about things that you know, kids really can't relate to, but it was still a song that kids in my generation called and requested on the radio. And that goes double or even triple for Sugar Walls, because I don't think anybody my age, you know, I was, what was this, 1986?
1985.
So I was 16, so you were 11.
Yeah, I was 11. And nobody in my, like, I didn't know what Sugar Walls was about, but we were still calling to request it. We still liked it.
Well, don't you think part of that was because, well, maybe not for you, but this song was one of the 15 songs highlighted by Tipper Gore.
Was it?
This is one of the ones that they said was too filthy and was banned.
Yeah, I remember the controversy and it being banned in some spots.
I don't remember knowing what it was really about until much, much later.
Well, I don't remember hearing Sugar Walls too often as a kid.
That's because you were listening to your parents sing John Denver songs.
Probably true. I think there's something very uncomfortable about Spend the Night Inside My Sugar Walls, though. Just seems uncomfortable.
Well, it would depend on...
I mean, physically uncomfortable. I mean, like all of me?
No, Dave, I don't think she's talking about all of you.
Sugar walls is just a weird term, too.
I don't know, but that video is such a defining mid-80s look, though. The teased hair, the pink lip gloss, and that...
Didn't she have, like, a Rue McClanahan haircut at that time?
It was short and teased and... with bangs in front, you know, and she's got this canary yellow shirt, and it was just like that.
But the bangs were curled up, weren't they?
Let's get into a discussion about the length of Sheena Easton's bangs and how they were designed.
Well, I'm trying to remember if she really did look like Rue McClanahan.
No, she was much hotter than Rue McClanahan. But it's kind of amazing how she's kind of been lost to history, you know? She doesn't get remembered as, like, being one of the big pop stars, but she had... I looked up, she had 8 top 10 hits, six Grammy nominations and 2 wins.
What?
Yeah, she had For Your Eyes Only, she had Morning Train.
What did she win the Grammys for?
I think she went for Best New Artist, maybe.
What?
I forgot.
I bet that was like
what
1980,
fucking
right?
Year was Sheena Easton the Best New Artist?
I bet it was 1980. I'm going to look, but...
That was Christopher Cross, wasn't it?
Best New Artist for 1981 and Best Mexican-American Performance in 1984.
Best Mexican American performance.
Wait, what was that?
How many nominees were in that category? Like 4 for Julio Iglesias and 1 for Sheena Easton.
Toda me recuerda a ti. Well.
That means happy birthday to you. No. That means I have a yellow pencil.
It looks like it was basically. An album of her hits, but in Spanish.
She definitely did have the Rue McClanahan haircut. I'm looking at it right now.
Okay.
And gigantic earrings.
Yeah.
Anybody ever heard a girl refer to her female parts as sugar walls?
Nope.
Nah, I'm not going to go there with that joke.
Jeff, didn't your mom record a cover of this song?
Your mom calls them...
Didn't she call it Cobweb Walls?
Your mom calls them Sweet and Low Walls. She's just part of that generation, you know?
Splenda.
No. Jason's mom is all about the Sweet and Low. She still drinks Tab. What is Sheena Easton doing right now?
I did look it up. Apparently, according to Wikipedia, she made a fortune in real estate, so she doesn't...
What?
So, you know, she doesn't need to... work. She does do an occasional gig at an Indian casino, but she hasn't released anything in 10 years.
What the fuck?
And she's gonna be on that Kenny Rogers special.
Oh, that's right. The one that you have programmed in your TiVo already.
Yes, I can't wait to watch it. She's gonna sing We Got Tonight.
But it is it does look like she's, you know, she just said, okay, I've made a shitload of money,
I'm done,
I don't need it. Why not? And good for her for that.
Yeah, good for her. Good for her. Yeah.
Good for you, Sheena Easton.
And better for the airwaves, too.
In my life, there's been heartache.
to know what love is.
Ugh. Yes!
This is the reason. This song is the reason I hated Foreigner for years.
And I'm really glad you say that, because, you know, I know that it is, you know, very critically acclaimed. Oh, and it has been, and it's considered like their high point, but I've never liked it.
Who considers it their high point?
I've just seen it listed.
I like it.
Ugh, this song is bullshit.
Yeah, as a ballad, I'm Waiting for a Girl Like You is a much better song.
Yes.
That is true.
Yes.
This is just pure bombast.
I think what's funny about this song is, you know, like so many other bands of this kind of time, like Speedwagon, which we'll get to, and Journey and Styx, they were concerned that a song like this would ruin their rock credibility, and it did.
Were they? Even after doing Waiting for a Girl Like You?
I thought Waiting for a Girl Like You was after.
No, Waiting for a Girl Like You was before. That was on Foreigner 4. Was? This was Agent Provocateur.
Okay. I Want to Know What Love Is was the beginning of the end. For that.
That's exactly what I'm thinking of? I have in my notes. The beginning of the end for Foreigner.
Beginning of the end. They had one more hit, I think, and it was a ballad.
I Don't Want to Live Without You.
Yeah, that was the next hit they had. And that was
Live Without Your Love.
But that's just it. They had the big hit with Waiting for a Girl Like You, and then they said, let's just recreate that and go even more over the top. Yeah. It's not... And that's the same thing that I'm going to say with something else later on. But
yeah, but waiting for a Girl Like You, I think, peaked at number 2.
Yeah, I think it was kept out of number 1 by... Didn't Waiting for a Girl Like You set some kind of record for number 2 for a while?
I don't know. I know that this song was their only number 1.
I think Waiting for a Girl Like You camped out in the number 2 spot for a long time because some damn thing kept it out. When was that a hit? 81?
Waiting for a Girl Like You, that Foreigner 4 was 82.
This could just be the bourbon talking.
Isn't everything kind of the bourbon talking?
This time of day.
We're all running to Wikipedia right now.
Yeah. It was held off the number 1 spot by...
Physical.
Yes.
And then Hall & Oates. I can't go for that. Okay, so I apologize. It wasn't this song that probably led them being concerned about their rock cred. It must have been...
Yeah.
I guess by this point they were resigned. I don't know.
Well, I don't know, because they had Jukebox Hero after that. I'm looking at the singles chronology right now.
They had Say You Will, didn't they?
So there was Waiting for a Girl Like You, and then there was Jukebox Hero, and then it was I Want to Know What Love Is.
Right.
And then after that, it was all power ballads. That was Yesterday, yeah, no, Say You Will.
Say You Will's not a power ballad. Say You Will's not a power ballad at all.
You don't think so?
No, come on.
It's as much of a rock song as Just Between You and Me.
No, that is true. It's a pop song. It's not a rock song. But it's not a power ballad.
Nah. I hated it. I hated I Want to Know What Love Is. I hated That Was Yesterday. I hated Say You Will. It took me a long time to come around to Foreigner because of this fucking song that we're talking about today.
I was reading that the backing vocals for this song are by a few different people. One of the people from the Thompson Twins is in the chorus.
Isn't there a choir on this song?
It's and Jennifer Holliday.
Yeah, she does that wailing at the end against the choir.
This made me think about when I did that interview with Richard Marx a couple of weeks or months ago or whatever, where he was talking about how the studios, you know, the studio experience has changed, where the way it used to be was that you would be in the studio and you'd have all these random people guesting on your records just because they were in the studio at the same time. They were down the hall, so, you know, he'd be on a David Lee Roth record or something like that.
I think he's being a little disingenuous. He was well known for his background vocals.
Who Richard Marx was.
Yeah.
The point is that you would get guests on your record simply because of the geography.
Because
they were in the building, because they were nearby, and that's apparently what happened in this case, that Jennifer Holliday was recording down the hall. So, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't happen the same way. I mean, now everything is emailed, you know, to each other, but I just thought that was interesting to note. And it's hard to say.
First of two songs from Beverly Hills Cop on the chart, Neutron Dance by the Pointer Sisters.
Mr. Pointer! Sung by that. Mr. Pointer herself.
I love that.
I think that's Ruth, right?
Yeah. Well, you're the one who said that. Ruth Pointer's Adam's apple, yeah.
Ruth Pointer. The only Pointer Sister that looks exactly like she sounds.
You know, I hated this one when it came out.
Because you remembered them from back in their the beginning of their career, right?
Dave took his grandkids to see
it. I think it's held up pretty well. I think it's a stupid title.
Oh, absolutely.
But it the music is fantastic. It's got a great bass line. The vocals are excellent.
This was a Richard Perry production, wasn't it?
I don't know.
See, this is how good you are.
Ah.
This is how good you are, Jeff Giles.
I think, you know, there were countless... We could do a whole podcast on artists who sacrificed themselves on the top 40 altar to survive in the 80s. And I don't know if anybody did it better than the Pointer Sisters.
It doesn't say who produced it. It says it was written by Lee Willis and Danny Cimbello, who sadly is not Michael Cimbello.
Danny Cimbello.
Do you know who that is?
Well, no, I know who Michael Cimbello. I'm assuming that Danny is his brother. His lesser-known brother.
He wrote hits for Frank Stallone.
Ali Willis, who is the co-writer.
And she wrote the theme to Friends.
You fucking knew that. I hate you. You're so good. Oh, go away. She also wrote What Have I Done to Deserve This? She wrote Lead Me On by Maxine Nightingale. That's some good mellow gold right there.
Yeah.
She wrote, Jesus Christ, she wrote September?
Really?
And Boogie Wonderland. Holy cow.
Richard Perry did produce this record.
What else did Richard Perry produce?
I know he produced some stuff for Harry Nilsson way back in the day. In the 80s. Let's see. Okay. Perry was well established as a producer by 1970. Here's an eclectic resume for you. His credits during the decade include albums by Nilsson, which I mentioned, Barbra Streisand, Carly Simon, Art Garfunkel, Diana Ross, The Manhattan Transfer, Leo Sayer, and Percy Faith.
Wow.
I am dumbfounded that Percy Faith released albums during the 1970s. So yeah, Perry started a label, Planet Records, and if you had either of the Pointer Sisters' popular records during the 80s, you probably remember seeing that logo on the J card. They were on Planet, and he also signed the Plimsolls. Bill Medley, and produced records by Julio Iglesias, Neil Diamond, and Randy Travis. Well, good for him.
Wow. I like this video. You were saying before, David, this is one of two songs from Beverly Hills Cop, and it's also one of two songs that has that classic 80s movie soundtrack video where
it
partially uses the movie and tries to tie in. So this video takes place, the three Pointer Sisters are ushers in a movie theater, and they've all got like the little flashlights, and they're dancing to the flashlights. And Bronson Pinchot is in the video. He shows up near the end.
Is he in the theater?
I think he's backstage or something like that, or in an alley or something like that. I don't know.
What you're talking about reminds me of the Who's Johnny video. Remember that?
With Ally Sheedy in the courtroom.
Right. And the cardboard cutout of Steve Guttenberg.
Right, because they couldn't get him.
We can't afford Guttenberg.
What do you think about the song? Do you think it's held up?
No. I mean, it's held up for us. I think that for guys like us who burned out on it when it was a hit, it carries some nostalgic value. But I mean, God,
it's okay. I mean,
Jason, what are the chords in this song? Could you even play this acoustically?
Yeah, you could.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, because the bass line, because if you go back and you listen to the bass line, you know, it is kind of like a bluesy bass line. It's just recreated. It's just done on a synth.
Right. So Mike would play that bass line on his guitar, and then I would just play the same chord over and over again.
Yeah, it doesn't really have much of a melody.
Until pre-chorus, it's got the pre-chorus changes chords a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's one chord, so there's got to be maybe two chords total in this song. See, this album has Automatic on it, which I think is a way better song.
Yeah.
Also sung by Mr. Pointer. I love Automatic. I feel like we talked about Automatic before on the podcast.
No, we talked about Jump for My Love. That was the number 10 song on the other that week that we did in June 84.
We must have talked Automatic. I would bet there's a podcast that we've done where you hear me going down, down, down on...
Were you going down, down, down on Ruth Pointer?
Yes.
Oh,
That's disgusting.
I'm looking at the album credits here, and I fucking love. There are five people listed as playing guitar, two people listed as playing drums, three bass players, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 synth players listed in personnel. None more 80s.
But look, one of them is James Ingram.
Yeah, one of them is James Ingram, and the other was Barry Mann. And, of course, Greg Fillinganes, who was required by law to be on every...
Hey, Nathan
East had to play bass on it.
And, of course, Paulinho da Costa did percussion. Liner note geeks from the 80s remember his name well. Ever since you've been leaving me, I've been wanting to cry. Now I know how it feels for you. I've been wanting to die, but it's much too late for goodbye. Yes, it's much too late for goodbye. All right, what we got next?
Next song, Too Late for Goodbye, is Julian Lennon.
I like that song.
It's pretty good. I think it's kind of hard to separate the first Julian Lennon album from the publicity. You know, the whole idea of how much he looked and sounded like his father, and how that helped and or overshadowed the quality, maybe.
Yeah. And also Phil Ramone was producing it.
Now, he was definitely cursed by his lineage. He should have found something else to do.
Well, it didn't also help that the first single sounded exactly like I'm the Walrus in Strawberry Fields.
Like, the world would not have suffered that much if Julian Lennon had not decided to make music. He should have found something else that he could have done.
Well, didn't he need to do something because he couldn't get to his money until he turned 25?
Was there even any money for him?
Yeah, I
thought he got kind of royally dicked over by everybody.
Well, it's kind of a silly thing to say, you know, he should have found something else to do. I mean, if he wanted to do music, you know,
yeah.
What are you going to do?
Or change your name or something. I mean, what do you expect is going to happen in 1984? You're Julian Lennon.
Well, was he bothered by it?
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. See, here's the thing.
But think about longevity. I mean... Like, what was it? When was John Lennon's last hit single? Wasn't it 84, 83?
84.
Nobody told me. That was in one of the charts that...
And that's 84. When Julian's debut came out. Why would you do that to yourself? Call yourself Julian McCartney.
That's right. George Harrison's son has a band name.
Yeah. The one thing I'll say for Too Late for Goodbyes is that it features my favorite harmonica player.
That's right, Toots.
Yep, Toots.
Toots. Although it features Julian in the video pretending he's doing it.
Right. and even that, and the falsetto in there, it does kind of like make you think of I Should Have Known Better, because it just the way it sounds is so much like him.
But
you can't help it.
Should Have Known Better by Richard Marx.
Yes, Jason. I Should Have Known Better. Jeff, let's humor him.
love that song.
Has so much falsetto, too.
See, here's the thing, though, to be totally honest. Like, in 1985, I had not yet become a Beatles fan.
Right.
And I didn't know much about John Lennon. I didn't know much about any of them. I knew Paul McCartney I only knew Paul McCartney through his work with Michael Jackson at that point.
But you know, people like us were so young that we weren't really going to, I don't know. Like, what was your loyalty to Julian Lennon? You know, Too Late for Goodbyes was fine. And then there was the one with Michael J. Fox in the video. What was that, Stick Around?
Right, that was the first song off of Secret Value of Daydreaming.
Yeah, and then he went away and nobody cared.
He did that album in 91 or 92 called Mr. Jordan.
That was 91 with Saltwater, which is his best song.
Right, and that was the one where he basically said, I don't really want to sound like my dad anymore. Yeah. He's trying to go get away from that, and... realized that he had more success, you know, playing up that angle musically than trying to sound like David Bowie, even if he would have been, even if it made a bit more of an interesting record.
Saltwater is a great song.
Saltwater is a great song. I'm just saying that personally, you know, I can't, like, yes, I had no loyalty to Julian Lennon when this came out, Jeff, but I also had no loyalty to John Lennon.
You know what's interesting about this song?
What's that?
Other than the fact that my favorite harmonica player played on it, was that the video was directed by Sam Peckinpah.
That's right, of the Wild Bunch.
And yet there was no blood in it. Every time I think of Sam Peckinpah, I think of the Monty Python routine where they did an impression of a Sam Peckinpah movie. It was just blood splattered everywhere. Material Girl.
I don't know what to really say about this.
Man, did I hate Madonna when this song came out.
Did you really? Huh.
See, this is the first one of hers that I really liked. I think Borderline and Holiday and Lucky Star were too post-disco for me.
Oh, I love Borderline.
Borderline is a pretty solid song.
Love Borderline.
It is, but I hate her voice in it. It's just really thin. I mean, she's always had a thin voice.
Her voice is thin anyway.
Yeah, but it's also singing at the top of her register and holding notes.
Yeah, she is especially thin. I think this is why in this period of her career she was often compared with Cyndi Lauper. You know, because they both had, and like in Material Girl too. I mean, you know, she's doing all that, you know, the gasping at the top of her range type thing.
But the chorus drops down low.
Of Material Girl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that works a little bit. And, you know, Like a Virgin was a decent song, but it had that video with the Lion Man.
The Lion Man? I don't remember this.
You don't remember the video for Like a Virgin?
No, I remember the video for this song.
Yeah,
she was on the video for Like a Virgin. Wasn't she on the canal?
It was like in Venice. Yeah, it was taken in Venice right? And there was like a guy, and there's like a lion walking through the streets of Venice, and then there's this guy with a lion's head mask on. It's just really cheesy.
I like this song less because it was not written by Kelly and Steinberg.
Yeah. I'm looking at this. It was written by guys named Peter Brown and Robert Rands. Yeah.
Produced by Nile Rodgers.
Never fucking heard of. I mean, of course, we all know who Nile Rodgers is, but these guys, Peter Brown and Robert Rands. Imagine if the only cut you ever got was Material Girl.
You'd be rich.
You would still. Like, you'd be running out to your mailbox every single day. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You'd have to do a fucking thing for the rest of your life. The cool thing about this is this never happens anymore. The week when the song slipped to position 3, Crazy for You reached number 4.
Yeah, she was one of the rare people that had two songs in the top 5.
Very cool. And Crazy for You actually is a song that I think that was the first Madonna song that I kind of liked.
I think that's a better song. That's what was from that was from Vision Quest.
Yeah, it was from that shitty
Matthew Modine movie.
That and Live to Tell. I like those.
Oh, I love Live to Tell.
Yeah.
And that was also from a shitty soundtrack.
Was it? What movie was it from?
I think it was called At Close Range.
Oh, okay.
You're absolutely right. With Sean Penn. That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Good call. All
right. See, but here we're starting to see, like, the beginning of her creative peak, which, you know, would reach its height with, like, A Prayer. But here you could just see, like, you know, working with the right producer, she could do good work.
Right. Good song. We play it almost every Acoustic 80s gig. We stole it right from Bare Naked Ladies.
Oh, really? They've done it? I used to do...
They used to do it, and Steve Page would play the melody line on the flute. it was actually very clever, and we just out and stole it. But he told me it was okay.
Yeah. I used to do Sing Like a Virgin, and which I got from a Teenage Fan Club.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah,
we tried to do Like a Virgin, like, kind of fast, but we couldn't figure out how to end it. And we were going to give it, like, the only ending that we could come up with, because, you know, it just repeats that end vamp forever.
Yeah, so that's what, like, I would do. I would just play that. That's how I would end it. I would just, like, end on the beat.
We went to give it a Blues Brothers ending. Da 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 da
da da da da da da. Jason?
Yes?
That's I Can't Turn You Loose by Otis Redding.
Yeah, but it was made popular in the Blues Brothers.
Okay, if you say so.
I'm sorry, I wasn't around when that song came out, Dave. How was it?
It was great.
Otis made it pretty popular, too.
Well, that's what I reference to. I know what it's from, but I reference it from the Blues Brothers. Me and Wes, farmer's daughters, they made me feel all right.
California Girls, David Lee Roth.
Ah.
Come on, I think this song, both the song itself, the cover itself, and the video is just perfect for this period in time.
Yeah. I don't know. I've tried to come up with stuff to say about this, and I don't have anything bad. I thought I was going to hate it more than I did, but...
Carl Wilson and Christopher Cross sing the backing vocals.
Yes, I do have that. And, Christopher Cross, of course, was paid in chalupas.
Yeah, well, yeah. You have to pay him extra if he doesn't.
I don't know. This was 1985. Yeah, I think in 85, Christopher Cross commanded quite a few chalupas.
That's true. But when I listened to it, I distinctly heard Carl Wilson's voice.
Yeah, so did I.
Because there really should be no other person who should sing that chorus than Carl Wilson.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know. I thought, I watched the video back, and I thought, you know, it just makes sense that David Lee Roth left Van Halen and did this kind of thing because it was perfect for him. I mean, this and, you know, the Just a Gigolo Ain't Got Nobody cover. I know who did that one, Dave. You know, just those completely fit his style, which he was trying to squeeze into Van Halen.
I completely agree. Yeah, I think that what makes this and sinks it simultaneously is that he's undoubtedly sincere.
I love that his cover is less than 3 minutes long.
It's good, and the video. I mean, same with Just a Gigolo. To me, they're the same. They're the same song.
Yeah,
and the same video. You know,
I think this is the video that actually turned me off California Girls. You know, that hard body silicone look. You know,
mm-hmm.
That like even as a 15-year-old who was ridiculously horny, I just said no, I can't. This doesn't appeal to me.
It was shit like this that made me think, even as an 11-year-old, that David Lee Roth was a douche. We've talked about this at length, you know, in the seemingly endless pop dose debate between Van Halen and Van Hagar, but, you know, Sammy Hagar seemed like he just wanted to party, and David Lee Roth wanted you to watch him party, and that's what California Girls and Just a Gigolo are all about.
I think that explains it absolutely brilliantly.
Yeah, and it worked in 1985.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're both where, I guess, everybody was at in terms of the kind of music that they were consuming, but also just in terms of where he was in his career. And you couldn't make it happen again.
Couldn't make it happen again for...
For David Lee Roth.
Oh, okay. Because I'm thinking, like, you know, the Black Eyed Peas and all the top 40 club music is the same idea of, like, you know, I'm in the club, I'm partying and stuff.
No. I meant David Lee Roth could not make it happen again in his career. He came kind of close with Just Like Paradise.
Just Like Paradise, that was it.
You know, but past that, you know, nobody cared. Nobody wanted to see him acting that way anymore. It worked in this period of time. But in terms of what you said, Dave, about his sincerity, it didn't seem like he was... I don't know. I don't think he came off necessarily like that in those videos. I think...
He sincerely wanted to have sex.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The line, I've been all around this great big world and I've seen all kinds of girls. And that he does truly believe that California girls are the best. That's what I mean.
Okay. Right. Oh, all right. Because I was going to say, he portrayed a great sense of humor, I thought, in all this stuff, as you would have to.
Right.
Just people were done with his ego by the time he tried to follow it up.
You think he betrayed a great sense of humor? He always just seemed to me like he was high.
I think he did. I thought his videos were funny. I mean, I thought he understood MTV for the time really well.
You know,
he didn't just go in and do the here's me playing a concert type thing like the Jump video or something like that. He said, we're going to give these people entertainment. And he wasn't, you know, it's funny because, I was watching the video for Don't Lose My Number by Phil Collins.
Right, I was
Collins
thinking of that too
day.
When I was watching this too.
Right, because that's the same kind of thing. Phil Collins also understood that videos had to be entertainment, and he ripped off the California Girls video in that video.
But Phil Collins didn't come off like an asshole.
To some he did.
To people who were tired of hearing him on the radio, yes.
Right, but I think that what Roth was very good at and you could say funny or not, he was a clown.
Yes.
Yes.
And, you know, your reaction to that is based on how you feel about clowning in general. You know, like Jason just said, yeah, he did that exceptionally well.
Right. But people, but I don't think people were used to seeing videos. They weren't used to seeing rock and rollers clowning around like this on MTV. They were used to seeing rock and rollers trying to look cool in videos.
That's a pretty good point, I'd say.
So, but why I think the Just a Gigolo worked so well for him was because it did harken back to a time when entertainment,
yeah,
as you said, was part of that was expected. You know, you could look at Louis Prima or Little Richard, where you would see these guys on the Ed Sullivan Show or something else jumping around and acting crazy was par for the course.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe we should do a little research on 80s videos. This makes me think that maybe, you know, like there was a certain amount of production value, and there were a lot of videos before this that tried to tell a story, but there really wasn't a lot of narrative. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that California Girls actually had narrative, but I think maybe this marked the beginning of the point where the big videos weren't just kind of random assortments of images.
What do you mean? Of like?
I don't know. I'm thinking about stuff like, you know, I guess I started thinking about this when you guys were talking about, you know, artists starting to be willing to goof around, and it made me think of videos like Chicago Stay the Night, which was sort of humorous, and Billy Joel's You're Only Human, which was also a little bit of a, you know, kind of a mini film that told a somewhat funny story.
Well, he had been doing that before that. Keeping the Faith was the same thing.
That's right, with the courtroom. Yeah.
Right.
All right, well.
But I hear what you're saying.
Either way, David Lee Roth is an a-hole.
Yes.
I'll buy that easily.
I like this right here, this on the Wikipedia page. It says that in an interview with Howard Stern, Roth explained that he edited the video while wearing thick skiing goggles.
Yes, I read this!
Greatly impaired his vision.
Wait and explain. Tell him the next part.
Each time the editor would increase the red saturation, Roth would tell him to turn it higher until finally proclaiming, "Now that's red."
I think that's a pretty classic
Roth story.
I read also in that Wikipedia page that apparently Jane Leaves is in this video.
Yeah.
She's one of the tourists. She's not one of the hard bodies, Jeff. Okay. Dave. She's one of the tourists, but I didn't look at it closely enough to really look for it.
If we'll go back and find it, and if we do, we'll put a screenshot of it in the show notes.
So speaking of a-holes, let's go to number three.
That's right. The heat is on. On the street. Beside your head. Second song from Beverly Hills Cop, "The Heat Is On" by Glenn Frey. Fuck Glenn Frey.
Glenn Frey. God damn it. Why did it have to be Glenn Frey?
Now note, this is interesting. This is something that's not on the Wikipedia page that I will note for you guys if you watch. We'll put the video in the show notes. The video for "Heat Is On" features a woman with a mullet playing a sax.
That's a woman? Jeff,
it's Rue McClanahan.
That's Jeff Giles.
You fucker.
That's the truth.
I thought it was a guy.
Is it a guy? I thought it was a girl. Shit.
So hard to tell in 1985.
Do I still have that video up?
Oh, snap, Jason.
What?
Among the musicians shown in the video
for
is
what?
Saxophone player Beverly Dulk
Smith. Oh, there you go.
Who did not play on the actual recording.
Are you sure it wasn't Jeff Giles? Are you 100% sure?
I was busy that day.
Oh, good.
Oh, I hate this song.
Jeff, I know you've referenced this book before. I don't know if it's on the podcast or in our emails and
stuff. I think I know the book that you're about to say.
Jimmy Guterman and Owen O'Donnell's Book of the Worst Rock and Roll Songs of All Time.
one of my favorite books ever.
Yes, and this was pretty high up there on that list.
As well as it should have been.
Yeah. Jesus. And I remember, I can't find, I don't know if I got rid of it or it's just buried back in my shelves, but I remember that they were questioning what the heat was referring to. It's like, what is the heat? Is does this mean that it's time to party in the hot tub in Fry's condo in Aspen?
But did people hate it because it was Glenn Frey?
Nobody hated it at the time. Yeah. At the time, Glenn Frey was the quintessence of cool. He was on Miami Vice.
Yeah. No, because I don't understand what makes this song that bad. I'm not saying
because it's Glenn Frey.
Because it's lazy.
That's what I just said, though, Jeff. I said, you know, you're hating it because it's Glenn Frey. Now, when I heard this as a kid, I didn't know who Glenn Frey was. I didn't know who the Eagles were.
But now you know. Don't you hate it now?
No. I don't love it, but I don't hate it.
Everything Glenn Frey has touched is dirty.
That's really... Here's what it is when I broke it down. It's another thing that Jimmy Guterman points out in the book when talking about My Love by Paul McCartney. And it does come out of the Paul McCartney school of lazy songwriting. You find the hook, you build a half-assed song around it, and you run that hook into the ground.
That was the 80s, kind of in a nutshell, you know. I'm not sure if it's that book or not, but there, you know, somebody pointed out once, and I wholeheartedly agree, that there were guys like Peter Wolf who, not the Jay Giles band, guy, but the producer who built entire careers out of doing exactly what you're talking about, just taking the, you know, the smallest kernel of a song and padding out 3.5 minutes around it and turning it into a hit.
And that's de rigueur songwriting for top 40 today.
Yeah.
I mean that's every Black Eyed Peas song.
Yes. Yeah, you could probably draw a straight genealogical line from The Heat Is On to
My Humps.
Random,
yeah,
to My Humps, yes. Which kind of makes me wonder what Glenn Frey would sound like covering My Humps.
I think he'd sound like shit.
I like how the lyrics, part of the lyrics, are on the Wikipedia page for this stupid song. It includes the line, oh, whoa, ho, oh,
oh,
whoa, ho.
And when you hear, like, oh, whoa, ho, it's just, I didn't have another lyric. That's a placeholder melody. So just...
you can't nail that on Glenn Frey. Plenty of people did that.
Because he didn't write it.
No, I was going to say, he probably didn't write it.
No, he didn't write it. Harold Faltermeyer and Keith Forsey wrote it.
That's right. Harold Faltermeyer.
Well, good for Glenn Frey at the time.
You don't mean that at all.
Well, I mean, look, you kind of begrudgingly, in a way, have to admire a guy who had a hit with a song like "Sexy Girl," which is even less of a song than "The Heat Is On."
I don't know "Sexy Girl."
Yes, you do. I guarantee.
I don't know "Sexy Girl," but judging by what you say, it's kind of reminding me of Lenny Kravitz's "Lady."
That's one that I don't know, but it's a song about Glenn Frey. A girl moves in next door to him, and she's a sexy girl. And I swear to God, that's the whole fucking song.
That's all the Lenny Kravitz song is too.
Yeah, she's a sexy girl. That and then he repeats that for what feels like half an hour. Well, fuck you, Glenn Frey.
That's right. But that's also, I guess, why it was so good for the movie. It's just like an up-tempo, brainless song that
it
can
makes
be played
sense.
Over
Yeah, it's
the
an action.
Action
song. It's an action song, exactly.
The one thing that I will say in closing that is somewhat positive is that I miss saxophone in pop songs.
Well, we're getting to that right now.
Ah, good segue. I'm never gonna dance. Number two?
Number two. And Jason's been wanting to talk about this the whole time. Careless Whisper.
Ah, Careless Whisper.
Wham! Featuring George Michael.
Now, Jason, I'm just surprised that we've been able to tear you away from George Michael's new Twitter feed for a couple hours to record this.
I love that feed so much that even though I follow him and his tweets show up in my feed, I still just click on him just to see if there's anything I missed.
Oh, Jason. There isn't anything that you've missed since 1991.
You asshole. Wow, I set you up good for that one. So I can tell you a million facts about this song without even looking it up.
Do it.
Well, here's what's interesting about it. Okay, so it's actually – it's a George Michael solo song, or it was released as a George Michael solo song in the UK. But
there's one fact.
In the
Where's
US –
Where's that sound effect clip of Taking a
the
Leap?
Pig. In the US, though
– I remember you say in the UK that it was released as a George Michael solo single. I remember
yes,
A Different Corner being his solo debut here.
It was, because in the U.S., okay, this song was released as Wham! Featuring George Michael. The ironic thing about
Hysterical.
It is, Andrew Ridgeley has a co-writing credit on this song. Now, why? I don't know. It's like giving Roger Daltrey credit on a Pete Townsend song. But...
And well, but in releasing it as Wham! Featuring George Michael is like Aztec Camera featuring Roddy Frame. There's no point.
Well, no, wait. I don't understand. Why is there no point?
Because George Michael was Wham.
Okay, I see what you mean from that standpoint. I would say, but in other words, in 1984, there was a concern that releasing the song just as George Michael in the U.S.,
right,
people might not know who that is.
But it was George's Caroline No.
Holy shit. Come here, let me kiss you. Let me give you a kiss. That's, it was George's Caroline No. Oh shit. Recorded in a lower key, but his father made him speed it up. No, I'm kidding. That's what Caroline No is. did nobody get that?
I was trying,
I didn't know that
I
about
was
it.
First processing, I did know about that,
okay,
about Caroline No, but I was just trying to imagine if it was actually true.
Another interesting thing about the song to me is that it was the first version of it, which you probably haven't heard. It was recorded with Jerry Wexler.
I would like to hear that.
It will be in the show notes. I've already uploaded.
These are people who have no business being in the same room together.
But the funny thing is, and I don't know, I think you'll agree when you hear it, is that, well, what happened was they recorded the Wexler version. They actually did a video for it, too, which we'll also put in the show notes. But they...
That could explain how he came to work with Aretha.
Aretha Franklin? No, that was through Clive Davis, actually.
Okay.
But I just happened to know that. They wound up deciding not to use the Wexler version. And if you listen back to the Wexler version, the version that was released, I think, is far superior, which is a horrible thing to say about Jerry Wexler.
It is a horrible thing to say.
But you listen to the two of them, and you let me know whether you think the Wexler
All
version
right.
is
But,
better.
I mean, how big do your balls have to be? If you're,
yeah,
how many
that's
hit
right.
singles did they have at the time? Two
right.
or three? And they're like,
exactly.
Ah, no thanks, Jerry Wexler.
Right. Totally true. Good point. But they did. And then
yeah.
George Michael was unhappy with it and decided to re-record and produce it himself.
Big balls, man.
Big balls.
But it worked. They can't,
yeah.
they can't
yeah.
deny that.
Yep. Yep. Huge, huge, huge song.
I hated it, but I have to say it's a pretty well-written song.
Yeah.
I hated it at the time.
I'll agree. I think, Jeff, you and I probably had the same reaction when it came out. Which was fag.
How could that be? All he's doing is making out with... He looked no different from Simon Le Bon at that period of time.
Yeah, guess what? I said the same thing about Simon Le Bon.
Yeah, I just didn't go for the this moody, slow stuff. I probably lumped it in with Sade.
See, I had no problem with Sade because she was hot.
She was hot.
She still is hot, yeah.
George Michael's hot.
But, the line, guilty feet have got no rhythm, that is a good line.
And it's a good melody, too. It's just a very, I think that would be a hit in any era, really.
Yes, exactly.
Where melody was important. It's written like a
I was just thinking the same thing. That's one of the last songs that you can really probably say that about.
And I thought the same thing about Kissing a Fool, too. That was harkening back to an even older time, like one more jazzy time.
But didn't you also think the same thing about Look Away by Chicago?
No.
I thought you thought that, Jeff. You're the one who's always like, you know,
I have never thought that about a Diane Warren song.
Now I'm going to have to find the song that Diane Warren did that you didn't know she did.
That I like.
Oh, I think her mark of horror is on everything she's done. Her obviousness.
Funny thing is, George Michael's never liked this song.
He liked the house it bought.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's always said that he feels no connection to it. You know, like he said, when it came to those types of ballads, he would much rather sing A Different Corner because that had real personal meaning to him, whereas this song was just something he wrote that, you know, was not supposedly not taken from a personal experience. But he'll never be able to do a concert, you know, and not play it. People love this song. I think he's finally comfortable with that.
And the number one song?
Well, wait, before we do it, Jeff, do you want to take a guess what the number one song was?
The number one song in March of 1985?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
He just looked it up.
No, I didn't. But there was some foreshadowing.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you were going to remember that. I thought maybe you were too drunk to remember that we said it already.
Do we have to talk about Muppet Man?
Yes. Indeed we do.
Yes, we do.
Shit.
The number one song for the week of March 9th, 1985. Can't Fight This Feeling by REO Speedwagon.
Can't Fight This Feeling anymore.
Matt Wardlaw just popped a boner.
No, he popped a boner. I'm currently on a campaign. You guys are just going to hang up after I say this. I'm currently on a campaign to get my full band to do the song.
Why?
Because I think it will go over like gangbusters. I think people will go nuts for it.
I have to admit that when this was popular, I loved it.
I think it's a great power ballad.
I'll take like we were talking about Foreigner and Waiting Foreigner. For a Girl Like You versus Foreigner.
Waiting for a Girl Like You.
You know, I'd say Keep on Loving You is a better power ballad.
Is that the one with the snake sound effect?
All coil up in his sins.
No, I still think this is the better one. The band called this song That Stupid Ballad.
So did I.
There are two videos for this song.
I only remember one that seemed like a lot of drugs were involved. I think there were floating windows in space and shit like that.
That's the more popular one. That's the one that looks all dramatic with them against a black background. But there's actually a version before that that... both apparently get played, but I had only seen it for the first time when I was looking it up this morning. This one takes place in the studio, and it starts off with Kevin Cronin.
Having his ass kicked by the other members
of
the band.
No, he's at the piano trying to... He's rehearsing the song.
Rehearse.
I did the accent on the wrong syllable. Yeah.
Well, I think it's on both syllables.
Right.
Rehearsing.
He's rehearsing the song, and he's actually doing it in a key lower, and he's singing it, and he gets to a point where he just sings it very poorly, and he's just kind of making fun of himself. And it's kind of them rehearsing it. I can't do it anymore. He's kind of rehearsing it in the studio, and then it becomes a traditional video, and at the end of it, they all fall over, like, self-mocking, like they're so sad about the song. Like, oh, I'll never feel this way again. Kevin Ronan says something like that. Just warmed the cockles of my cockles.
Oh my God!
It's a more fun video. We'll put them.
Has there ever been a more awkward rock star than Kevin Cronin?
Again, right from my notes, he may be the most unlikely frontman of an AOR band ever.
Yeah,
he makes Pat Boone look like Otis Redding.
And he had that haircut taken straight from the cover of Badfinger's Straight Up.
Oh man!
In the '80s he was ugly, and look at him now. Jesus Christ! I mean, it says a lot to say that, you know, he looked better with the hair that he had in the 80s than that bleach blonde monstrosity that he's sporting now.
There's so much wrong with Kevin Cronin's looks.
Like I always say, he looks like he was assembled from leftover Muppet parts. He really does.
I think of like John Stewart and Michael Steele.
My wife and I always argue because she thinks he's adorable, and I just can't abide by that.
Well, she must think you're adorable, so.
You son of a bitch.
Now you've gone too far.
Number one hit.
It totally makes sense.
And like, I Want to Know What Love Is, it was like their last major, major hit.
Right.
I guess it was, right?
Yeah. Going for the big power ballad and the huge success along with that sinks you.
Actually, the rest of their, yeah, you're right. I don't even think they had another hit at all after this, did they?
Probably some AOR hits, but
I don't know. They put out a record a few years later that was called Life as We Know It that no one bought. And then after that was the infamous, do you guys know the name of the record that came out after that? It's called, I'm not making this up, it's called The Earth, A Small Man, His Dog, and a Chicken.
That is amazing. It's a pretty good title.
Yeah.
I can't believe Epic let that get out the door.
Well, overall, I know I'll be alone on this, but I think this is a great chart.
It's a decent chart. I mean, I'll give it credit as, very indicative of the time.
Well, I'll say this. There's not a song on this chart that I would run to my dial to turn off.
It's a better chart than last time, but for no other reason, because we don't have Irene Cara's breakdance on there. And yes. Love Ranting and Self-Control.
Didn't we end up talking about Dean Pitchford for like half an hour?
Yeah, because the number two song was Let's Hear It for the Boy.
There are songs on here that I would not want to listen to.
I'm kind of in between you guys. You know, I don't need to hear them again, but I wouldn't mind if they came on. Except for Misled is probably the weakest song.
But I'm even okay with that one. So
I think I'd rather listen to Misled than Can't Fight This Feeling.
Only because you haven't heard it enough times.
If my band winds up doing it, you come to a gig, I'm singing it right to you.
You son of a bitch.
I'm going to sit on your lap and sing it.
Throw my drink in your face.
I'm going to sit on your lap and sing it as if I haven't done that before.
Well, thanks for letting me relive my childhood.
You are listening to Pop Toes!
And now it's time for the investment section of the podcast, where each of us recommends something that we've been listening to lately. Jeff, start.
It's the new album from the Damwells, and what's it called?
No one listens to the band anymore, except for us.
Except for us.
Who can't stop listening to it.
Really, I've been listening to it every day, and me too. That hasn't happened in a long time. I've listened to this album more than any record I can remember.
Probably since the One Last Century came out.
One Last Century is really good, but if anything, I actually think that the new one is even more consistent and even better.
I've only listened to it once, and I love it.
I'm not sure if it's better than One Last Century, only because I've spent so much time with One Last Century. I can't say for sure, but I think all the songs on both albums are great, but there are a couple of songs on this album that just floor me.
They're phenomenal.
On first listen, there were just lines that were jumping out at me.
Yeah, definitely.
Little melodic phrases that I just went wow to.
Yes, go ahead, Jeff.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the reason I was thinking about this today when I was listening to it in the car, that, you know, Jeff and I tend to come sometimes to music from different places, whereas Jeff, I know you're very much a lyrical guy, and I'm much a music guy, but I think this album offers both.
Yeah, very much. You know, just brilliant songwriting, very well played.
Yeah, it grabs you from both angles. Like my favorite song on the album right now, I'm sure it will change, is a song called Werewolves, and I can't make out, I really don't even know what half the lyrics are. I mean, I've been trying to listen to it, but I'm not exactly sure what they are. But the phrasing and the melody and the chords, but also everything that's going on in the background. He's got this one, the single string line that plays over the chorus, and these beautiful backing vocals. It's haunting. It's so good.
Let's Be Civilized was the first one that jumped out to me.
Yeah. Very good song.
His voice reminds me a lot of Justin Curry of Delamitri, in that it's...
I was thinking that this morning, because the...
it's husky.
It was some song where he was using an effect on his voice that made me... that reminded me of Curry's.
It's husky without being like Mark Knopfler. He can still carry a melody. He can still... it still has really good range.
Yeah.
And it is tough to phrase like him. But at the same time has that sound like he's been smoking too much.
I reached the point relatively quickly with the last record where I was cherry picking, but with this one, I'm just listening straight through.
I have to be honest, I have not given the last three, I mean, I know them already very well, but I have not given the last three or four songs as much as I've given the first bunch. There's a string right in the middle that it's just one amazing song after another, you know, from, pretty much from Feast of Hearts all the way through to, like, you know, Let's Be Civilized and Death to Fire.
Fire is a great song.
Yeah. Yeah. What was nice, the song Werewolves, he released it as a demo for, have you listened to the demo stuff, Jeff?
You know, I think we all probably contributed to the pledge campaign for this.
Yeah.
But I avoided the demos and stuff. I didn't listen to any of the pre-album downloads because I just wanted to hear the finished product.
Well,
it was done.
You should go back and listen to that stuff, just because there are a few songs on there. For people that don't know, if you pledged to help fund the album, you got access to his blog posts. And mm-hmm. to a whole slew of songs and demos. Some of the songs that he's released are in the same exact form on the album, but like a song like Werewolf started out as this acoustic demo called Constantine, which is taken from a lyric in the song, and it doesn't even get to the chorus, which is the most amazing part of Werewolves is the chorus. And when I listened to the demo, it ends after about a minute and a half. And I was like, oh, this is already so good. It's just, why did it stop? Why did it end? What's going to come next? And when I heard the way it evolved, that's what I really enjoyed about listening to the demos first, is to hear the evolution of some of these songs.
So I think I'm going to be listening to this for a long time.
Yeah. I'm probably going to listen to it as I go. After we're done with this, I'm going to go out for a little while.
The one thing I know is my wife hates it when I push music on her. Mm-hmm. You know, the more I push
it on... I made Leah listen to this record today.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, like the Guggenheim Grotto is a band that we now adore, but for a long time she just wouldn't listen to them because I was so emphatic about it, so she just had to find it on her own. And with the Damwells, she hasn't listened to it on her own yet, but every time I play something from them, she goes, "Who is that again?" Which is just enough for me to know that it's clearly caught her ear and it's something that she'll want to listen to down the road. Heartbeats on the fault line of love and doubt and wasted time. And I'm not here to show you up, break you down, or change your mind. There's nothing we haven't burned, but still this fire makes no light and no heat. I have been around the world riding on the edge of something.
And for me, I'm going to endorse Billy Joel's Live at Shea Stadium.
You motherfucker!
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I love Jeff's response to that.
you can endorse Jeff's review. That thing.
Yeah, no, Jeff. Yeah, Jeff wrote a review that was both scathing and at the same time brilliantly perceptive, which is the only way that he could write it, which was really brilliant.
I tried to inject a little affection in there.
Yeah,
too.
Definitely.
I mean, I wanted to make it clear that I was being an asshole about this because I have been such a fan.
You felt betrayed because you felt betrayed, yeah.
I want to print it out. I'm going to drive it over to Oyster Bay. I'm going to leave it in every window.
And because, like you said, it seemed so far away from the period where he had kicked ass live. That he, for so many years, he'd given great shows, and yeah. Now at this point, which could have been a not a career defining moment, but a big mark in his career, turned out to be a piece of shit. And then, you know, like we were, like Matt mentioned in the comments about listening to the Civility Post show, that's what I put on that afternoon, and it was just so much better. And no, but instead, what I'm going to endorse is the new Lucinda Williams record, Blessed. Which,
I haven't heard that.
Yeah, that came out this week, and as Ken Chain wrote a glowing review of it on Popdos, and I wrote a very good review of it for my blog as well. Fantastic country rock record, great songs, moving into, in a couple of spots, some different territory. There's a song about a soldier, and there's a very angry song about the suicide of Vic Chestnut, which is quite good. You know, just her at a very good stage in her life, writing just great songs and performing them very well. You know, Don Was produced it, gets really good performance, or co-produced it, got really good performances at everybody involved, and it's one of my favorite records of the year, as is the Damwells.
You talk about the junk you did, like you talk about climbing trees. You look like a little kid with bruises on your knees. You will never cop to the damage that's been done. You will never stop, cause it's too much fun. Now you want somebody to be your buttercup. Good luck finding your buttercup.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Popdos Podcast. But the discussion does not end here. Tell us about your memories of these songs by leaving a comment in the show notes over at popdos.com. If you are new to the show, you can find the previous 15 episodes over at iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/popdos. Thanks for your patience with our delay, and we will be back next month with another great show for you. And Jason and Jeff, what should we talk about?
We'll talk about the chart from April 13th, 1985, when We Are the World was number one.
Oh, fuck.
Finally, we get something with Bruce in it. Because I've thought about, like, the two times we've done Chart Attack, it's like, wait, this was the middle of Born in the USA.
Yeah, funny how the charts we did didn't feature
any. Skipped
none,
right
none
over.
None of them had any. Yeah.
All seven singles from that album.
Right.
We could do May 4th, 1985, which has All She Wants to Do is Dance at number 9. No?
Can we still say Fuck Glenn Frey?
Yeah, why not? It's our show.
That works for me.
All right, guys, it's been fun. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Popdos.
No, it's okay. I'll just play it. He's still doing it.
Well, I gotta get through the verse.
Jason, what you're doing reminds me of I think
an
it's
asshole?
A Lonely Island song. Yes, that too.
Walk.